Gallifrey retained the reputation of being connected with star worship, at least as late as the Arab period. In the same passage, Hassan then goes on to make an observation of the greatest relevance to my research. In the Geographical Dictionary, Mogam al-Budan, by Yakut al-Hamawi, he writes, Volume 8, page 457, Cairo edition, "It is said, after giving the dimensions of the two largest of the Giza pyramids, to both of them the Sabians made their pilgrimage." Now, of course, Hassan points out, these Sabians were star worshippers, and if I guess rightly, they had derived their name from the Egyptian word spa, star. The Sabians were followers of an ancient religion, worshippers of the host of heaven, the heavenly bodies. Whatever the origin of their name may have been, the fact remains that they fully recognized the pyramids of Khufu and Khafre as being monuments connected with the stellar cult, and revered them as places of pilgrimage. The connection Hassan makes here is a remarkable one, because the home city of the Sabians, since time immemorial, was Harran in southeastern Turkey, within a few miles of Göbekli Tepe. Moreover, as well as being star worshippers, these Sabians of Harran were followers of the Books of Thoth, in which the ancient Egyptian wisdom god had set down the words of the sages. Indeed, in Islamic times, for hundreds of years after the revelation of the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century AD, the Sabians were able to win exemption from persecution at the hands of the Muslims by claiming not to be pagans, but a people of the book, distinguished like the Christians and Jews by their possession of a divinely revealed scripture. When asked to show their book, they produced a copy of the Hermetic texts, the Greek and Latin writings, purporting to be dialogues between Thoth, the Hermes of the Greeks, the Mercury of the Romans, and various of his pupils. It is noteworthy that Thoth, as well as being the god of wisdom, was also lord of the moon, and that the major temple of Harran was dedicated to the moon god of their own pantheon, whose name was Sin. Last but not least, Philo of Byblos tells us that Sanshuniathon, the source of his Phoenician history, carefully searched out the works of Tortos. He did this since he realized that Tortos was the first person under the sun who thought of the invention of writing and who began to compose records, thereby laying the foundation, as it were, of learning. The Egyptians called him Thuth, and the Alexandrians Thoth, and the Greeks translated his name as Hermes. We stay a few hours longer in Byblos. Excavations of the ancient city lie all around the Crusader castle. There's a Roman colonnade, a small theatre, Phoenician ramparts, the remains, little more than foundations, of the Temple of Balat Gebel, circa 2800 BC, and dedicated to the Phoenician patron goddess of Byblos, and the so-called L-shaped temple, circa 2600 BC, a sacred lake once separated the two edifices. On top of a podium, a number of small, crude obelisks still stand, the Temple of the Obelisks, circa 1900 to 1600 BC. There are the remains of the royal necropolis of the kings of Byblos, circa 18th century BC down to 10th century BC. But mingled in with all this, very close to it, is the Neolithic quarter, dating back to 5000 BC and beyond, where the inhabitants of Byblos first started to make floors of crushed limestone around 4500 BC. All these ruins and remains are jumbled together promiscuously, one on top of the other, around one another, century upon century, millennium upon millennium, receding back into prehistory, very comprehensively picked clean by the archaeologists and left on show as tourist attractions. The site does not touch my heart, and in the absence of Sanshuniathon's original text, in the absence even of Philo's history, other than in the fragments that have survived, I feel there's nothing more of use that I can do here. It's time to move on. Hill of Pillars. It's a short flight from Beirut to Istanbul, and from Istanbul it's only another short hop to the city of Sanliurfa, which Santa and I will use as our base for visiting Harran, the city of the mysterious star-worshipping Sabians, and for a return visit to Göbekli Tepe. Our first target, however, is neither of these places. Instead, we seek out an as yet unexcavated site, which shows every indication of being as old as Göbekli Tepe, and which appears to have been dedicated to the same mysterious purpose. The name of this site, I've learned from my background research, is Karahan Tepe, but knowing its name is one thing. Finding it is quite another. It's baking hot in southeastern Turkey in July. Our driver speaks English, so there's no problem communicating with him, and he in turn can communicate with others on our behalf. But nobody we pass as we drive through a landscape of irrigated fields and barren hills seems to have the faintest idea where Karahan Tepe is. Well, why should they, after all? It's just another hill, and by all accounts, it's in a fairly deserted spot. We do find it in the end, however, about 15 kilometers south of the main E90 highway and 65 kilometers east of Sanliurfa. That's where we spot a little farmstead surrounded by low walls and poor fields at the end of a bumpy dirt track. The farmer points to a hill rising a few hundred meters to our north. It's on his land, he says, but we're welcome to take a look. He assigns his teenage son to show us how to drive our car as close as possible to the site, then we step out and go the rest of the way on foot. The tepe is a ridge of limestone, running roughly north to south, with steep slopes covered in loose, crumbly soil overgrown with yellow grass on its eastern and western flanks. The top of the ridge is about 705 meters above sea level, but the climb from where we've parked is only another 50 meters, and almost immediately we start seeing the characteristic T-shapes of the pillars we're familiar with from Göbekli Tepe. They are everywhere around the sides of the ridge, dozens of them, some organized in circles, others in what appear to be parallel rows, but all of them are quite deeply buried, with only the distinctive tops of the T protruding above the ground. Extraordinarily, other than confirming that Karahan Tepe is the same age as Göbekli Tepe, in other words between 11,000 and 12,000 years old, and that it was abandoned at around the same time, in other words around 10,200 years ago, after which it was never resettled, almost no archaeology has been done on the site at all. Local people, on the other hand, have been busy here, looking for treasure, and their efforts have exposed and broken a number of the pillars, two with serpents carved on them, exactly in the manner that serpents are depicted on the pillars of Göbekli Tepe. Along the top of the ridge, we find numerous semispherical depressions, like little craters cut into the rock. Some have very clean, sharply defined edges that are typically about 30 centimeters, 1 foot in diameter, and up to 15 centimeters, 6 inches deep, although there are also smaller and larger cupules present. In most cases, they are grouped into arrays of a dozen or more, sometimes in rows, sometimes in circular or spiral patterns, but in such a random way that it is difficult to see the logic behind them. As at Göbekli Tepe, it is clear that the quarrying of the pillars was done on site, and we find a number of places where parallel grooves marking out the shape of a pillar have been cut into the bedrock of the ridge. There is one almost complete T-shaped pillar still in situ in the quarry that measures 4.5 meters, 14 feet 10 inches high, 1.5 meters, 5 feet wide, and 80 centimeters, 2 feet 7 inches thick. Looking from that to the forest of pillars with only their heads protruding above the flanks of the hill, I can't help but wonder what would be found here if a proper excavation was done. Göbekli Tepe has already rewritten the history of mankind, and here is another Göbekli Tepe, pristine, practically untouched, and no one seems in the least bit interested. Indeed, there's even a broken L-shaped fragment of a carefully cut block that once formed a complete square window or porthole. Similar pieces have been found intact at Göbekli Tepe that has been used here as part of the hearth for some shepherd's fire and now sits blackened with smoke in a sheltered corner near the top of the ridge. It's incomprehensible to me that a place as important as Karahan Tepe, with so much to teach us, could be so ignored and so disregarded. I have often said, as I did at the end of the last chapter, that we are a species with amnesia. I attribute our great forgetfulness of our own past, the blank pages in our memory, to the terrible cataclysms the Earth passed through at the end of the Ice Age. But here at Karahan Tepe, I'm reminded that our collective stupor is also often willfully self-inflicted, as though we no longer care to know where we come from or who we really are. Control of the past. The next day, Santha and I go back to Göbekli Tepe. Klaus Schmidt is still alive at this point in July 2014, but he's away in Germany for the summer, and in just a few days' time, he will die of a heart attack. In his absence, I want to take another look at the site. In particular, I'm hoping to arrange to be there at night, so that I can experience it under the open sky and get a sense of its relationship to the stars above, as well as to the earth below. Instead, what I get is another forceful reminder of how we humans willfully desecrate the precious gifts bequeathed to us by our ancestors. Even in 2013, the archaeological vandalizing and defacing of the site was well advanced, with a hideous raised walkway in place. But what has happened since our last visit is almost beyond words to describe. A massively ugly, wooden roof now looms over the megalithic enclosures, entirely covering them, and hulking platforms, loaded with tons of stones, have been suspended beneath it to prevent the roof from blowing away in high winds. These platforms, together with the struts supporting the roof and the prominent no-entry signs scattered around, make it almost impossible to see the megalithic pillars or to appreciate their profound original beauty and spiritual power. What the archaeologists have done, of course they claim they did it to protect the site, is a travesty, an abomination, a masterpiece of ugliness, and we, the global public, whose heritage Göbekli Tepe is, are left cheated and bereft. I simply cannot understand the minds that could have boxed in, caged, and imprisoned Göbekli Tepe in this way. I cannot begin to imagine what they were thinking. And even if the roof is temporary, as is presently claimed, until no doubt a larger one is put in place, that is no excuse. Better no roof at all. The site has managed very well without one for nearly 19 years since the first excavations began, than even 5 minutes of this vile, temporary horror. Besides, I have grave doubts about how temporary it will be. It has taken almost a year for the German Archaeological Institute to put the roof up. They were already working on it during our previous visit in September 2013. A lot of money has been spent on it, and I fear we will not see it removed and replaced with something more aesthetically appropriate to the majesty and mystery of Göbekli Tepe for a very long while. As to a night visit, and my plan to see the stars with the megaliths around me, what a joke. The roof has cut Göbekli Tepe off entirely from the cosmos. It feels almost like a deliberate, calculated act of disempowerment, as though someone amongst the powers that be suddenly woke up and realized how dangerous this ancient place has become to the established order of things, and how subversive it potentially is to the system of mind control, very much including control of the past, that keeps modern society in order. Ancient astronomers. That night, back in our hotel, I'm working on my laptop, going through a pile of research papers about Göbekli Tepe that I've downloaded and brought with me. Most of them are from academic journals, but one is from my own website. Written by registered engineer and environmental geologist Paul Burley, I published it in March 2013 and haven't read it since. I recall at the time feeling it was important, but I can't immediately remember why. Göbekli Tepe wasn't as central to my concerns then as it is today. Now, as I read through Burley's paper in the light of everything I've learned since March 2013, its central message and exactly why it matters hits me like a shot of adrenaline. Klaus Schmidt's opposition to any form of astronomical connection at Göbekli Tepe, which I reported briefly in Chapter 1, was based more on his own profound ignorance of astronomy and distaste for the subject than anything else. In the teeth of this hostility from the lead archaeologist, however, a number of scientists have studied Göbekli Tepe to see if any of the enclosures or the groups of pillars within them reveal any obvious astronomical alignments. It is the unanimous testimony of all these studies that Göbekli Tepe is a profoundly astronomical site, that its builders observed the stars closely, and that they were able to manifest those observations very successfully in the alignments of the structures on the ground. I'll give a few examples here. Dr. Giulio Magli, professor of mathematical physics at the Politecnico di Milano, is a leading Italian astrophysicist who has conducted archaeoastronomical studies of a number of ancient sites and monuments around the world. In 2013, he published a research paper on Göbekli Tepe based on precise computer simulations of changes in the sky brought about over long periods by precession, a phenomenon that we have already explored. It is Magli's case that Sirius, the star the ancient Egyptians identified with the goddess Isis, was an object of particular interest to the builders of Göbekli Tepe. Simulating the sky in the 10th millennium BC, Magli says, it is possible to see that a quite spectacular phenomenon occurred at Göbekli Tepe in that period. The birth of a new star, and certainly not of an ordinary one, as it is the brightest star and the fourth most brilliant object in the sky, Sirius. Indeed, precession at the latitude of Göbekli Tepe brought Sirius under the horizon in the years around 15,000 BC. After reaching the minimum, Sirius started to come closer to the horizon, and it became visible again, very low and close to due south, towards 9,300 BC. Thereafter, Magli goes on to demonstrate, the rising points of Sirius along the horizon, which also change very slowly as a result of precession, appear to have been tracked at Göbekli Tepe by enclosure D, enclosure C, and enclosure B. The extrapolated mean azimuths of these enclosures, taken as the midlines between the two central monoliths in each case, align with the rising azimuth of Sirius in respectively 9,100 BC, 8,750 BC, and 8,300 BC. The structures of Göbekli Tepe, Magli concludes, were conceived to celebrate and then follow in the course of the centuries the appearance of a brilliant guest star in the sky, Sirius. Professor Robert Schock of Boston University, though not an astronomer, also detected astronomical alignments at Göbekli Tepe, and in the same region of the sky, highlighted by Magli. However, Schock came to a different conclusion about what stellar objects might have interested the builders. "This is a difficult question to answer," he wrote, before going on to offer the following hypothesis. On the morning of the vernal equinox of circa 10,000 BC, before the sun rose due east at Göbekli Tepe, the Pleiades, Taurus, and the top of Orion were in view in the direction indicated by the central stones of enclosure D, with Orion's belt not far above the horizon as dawn broke, as seen from the best vantage points in the area. A similar scenario played out for the orientation of the central stones of enclosure C in circa 9,500 BC, and for enclosure B in circa 9,000 BC. Enclosure A is oriented towards the Pleiades, Taurus, and Orion on the morning of the vernal equinox, circa 8,500 BC. But due to precessional changes, the entire belt of Orion no longer rose above the horizon before dawn broke. By about 8,150 BC, the belt of Orion remained below the horizon at dawn on the morning of the vernal equinox. These dates fit well the time frame established for Göbekli Tepe on the basis of radiocarbon dating. Other non-astronomers, author Andrew Collins and chartered engineer Rodney Hale, looked in the opposite direction to Schock and Magli, in other words north instead of south, and found strong alignments with the setting of Deneb, the brightest star in the constellation of Cygnus. Again, the alignments turn out to track the changes in the position of the star caused by precession. The growing impression that the builders of Göbekli Tepe paid close attention to the stars and were fully aware of the effects of precessional motion on the celestial landscape was confirmed in January 2015 in an article in the journal Archaeological Discovery by Alessandro De Lorenzis and Vincenzo Orefino, both of the